were up 1,700 jobs, which is an amazing preliminary result for the year. Very solid growth.
A rosy outlook for the Anchorage economy. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Parnell considers changing the gas and oil tax structure.
We're going to work with the committee to see that we can work through the decoupling issue in a way that's more revenue neutral and not as big of a gap as there is currently in the bill.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The Parnell administration is ready to talk about separating oil and gas taxes. 2 years ago, the governor vetoed a bill that would have collected revenue from each resource independently. The bill has been reintroduced, and this morning, Revenue Commissioner Brian Butcher told the Senate Finance Committee that times have changed. At the time of the veto, he said the state was involved in open seasons on two gas pipelines from the North Slope to the Lower 48. That no longer is the case. Butcher also reminded the committee that the governor wants to rewrite the tax on gas during next year's session.
What the governor's looking for is the bill to be closer to revenue neutral. As we're looking at House Bill 110 and doing what we can to increase the investment climate for the companies in Alaska, we don't want to at the same time put something in that could be taking it the opposite direction. So we're going to work with the committee to see that we can work through the decoupling issue in a way that's more revenue neutral and not as big of a gap as there is currently in the bill.
Having the oil and gas tax structures combined or coupled in the tax code allows producers to use tax credits for one fuel against profits from another. Tax consultants don't see a problem with that when there is a close relationship between the two fuels. But right now there is no parity. Oil is worth 37 times the value of gas, and that could cost the state as much as $2 billion a year in revenue. The bill's sponsor, Senate Finance Co-Chair Bert Stedman, says oil and gas companies have pointed to the importance of a stable fiscal regime before they commit to development. And he says the decoupling issue is the most unstable element in state law.
I expect the current impact on the Treasury to be very small, in the tens of millions versus almost $200 million a couple years ago. But it pales in comparison to $2 billion, negative number. So if you have an issue like that embedded in our tax structure and you make a change in oil, you better make sure you're looking at the net effect, or you may have no net at all.
Stedman says the decoupling issue will likely be included in a more comprehensive oil tax bill. Legislators are looking into the Alaska Department of Natural Resources' move to change their mission statement. Representative Berta Gardner is the Democratic whip in the House representing Midtown Anchorage. She says legislators have asked for a research report on the matter.
The legislature has the power to set the mission of each department. And historically, the legislature has renewed that every year, but apparently several years ago did not do it. To me, it seems pretty clear by statute that the legislature sets the department's missions. And I haven't seen any statute that says that if we fail to do so on an annual basis, they can do it themselves. That's not in statute.
In an email statement, Sullivan's staff claims, quote, according to the Department of Law, it is okay for a department to set a mission statement in the absence of the legislature doing so. The last legislatively approved mission statement expired in 2003, end quote. DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan issued a new mission statement on January 17th. For the second time in 3 days, Anchorage was treated to a positive economic forecast for 2012. While the numbers varied between the State Department of Labor and the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation reports, the shared projected trend was reassuring. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
At the conclusion of his presentation, AEDC President and CEO Bill Popp
noted in a folksy style that the city was rising from the economic valley of 2009.
A few years ago, my mantra was flat is good. Well, not no more. We are growing again, and we will hopefully continue to grow for the next several years. And as our Business Confidence Index survey demonstrates, we're definitely solidly confident in the future of the Anchorage economy in the coming year.
Armed with Labor Department data and perhaps a crystal ball, POP was presenting the corporation's annual analysis of Anchorage's economy for 2011 and 2012. The combination of the economic forecast plus keynote speaker Steve Forbes attracted more than 1,500 community and business leaders to Wednesday's luncheon at the Dena'ina Center. For the last 4 years, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation has conducted a Business Confidence Index. POP listed the questions answered by nearly 190 Anchorage businesses, ranging from small to large.
Will you spend more money on capital expenditures in the coming year? Will you hire more people? Will your net profits be better this year? And do you think your gross sales are going to increase? Well, I'm pleased to report that every one of those indicators moved up substantially.
In the first index for 2009, confidence about the upcoming year was about 50%. The 2012 composite results showed a 60% optimism rate. That positive attitude matched the pattern of POP's statistical findings, based on State Department of Labor data and analyzed by the McDowell Group along with AEDC staff.
We were up 1,700 jobs, which is an amazing preliminary result for the year, based on Department of Labor statistics through the month of December. That's about a 1.1% increase.
POP had another happy comparison, equally important to those hoping for continued recovery from 2009, when for the first time in 20 years, the total of Anchorage jobs did not increase, but fell.
What's really interesting is that in the fourth quarter, we saw 2,900 jobs more in the fourth quarter of 2011 than we saw in the fourth quarter of 2010.
POP's numbers show that 2011 recorded the highest employment numbers in Anchorage's history. POP's AEDC estimate forecast 1,500 new jobs and continued growth for at least 2 years after that. POP lists two major concerns, though: the threatened reduction of federal dollars into Alaska, with the up-to-now inability of the state to resolve the regulatory issues over extractive industries, in particular, oil. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, good and bad news for the fetal alcohol syndrome rates in Alaska.
We're seeing a 49% decline among Alaska Native infants and a 64% increase for non-natives during the study period.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The commercial halibut catch will drop by just over 18% coast-wide this year. The International Pacific Halibut Commission voted on the limits at the end of its annual meeting this morning. Southeast is the only area in Alaska that will actually see a small increase after several years of steep reductions. From Petersburg, KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has more.
The commission approved a catch totaling just over 33.5 million pounds for Alaska, Canada, and the Pacific Northwest. That's down roughly 18% from last year, though as usual, the change varies from area to area. Overall, the commission's scientists continue to see a drop in the abundance of fish big enough to harvest, known as the exploitable biomass, or e-biomass. As they revise their research with new data each year, they're also finding they've overestimated the stocks in recent years. The commission and its staff are working to develop new management policies to address the problems in the future. This year's cut results partly from a change in the scientific model they use to assess stocks. U.S. Commissioner Ralph Hoard spoke in support of the staff recommendations.
We have a professional staff that has done the science on halibut since 1924, and I think we should follow their lead. Well, I'm going to push for new systems in the future to be peer-reviewed. With the serious decline in e-bio over the last few years, I don't think we have the luxury to wait under the current circumstances. I am therefore supporting our scientists, and this rationale goes for all the motions I'll be making on the other areas.
The cuts were too steep for another U.S. Commissioner, Philip Lestenkoff, who opposed the staff numbers. Lestenkoff wanted to stick with the model the Commission has used for the past several years, one that would have meant a smaller reduction of 9% coastwide.
Many in the halibut industry are advocating for more review before we implement new models.
But the other five commissioners voted to go with staff recommendations for this year in all areas except 2B, which is British Columbia, where they approved a total allowable catch or TAC of just over 7 million pounds. That's a cut of about 8% from last year, instead of the 13% cut proposed by staff. The Canadian delegation's Michael Pearson reemphasized the need for caution in the face of overall stock declines and past overestimates, but he also pointed to uncertainties in the science as well as improved catches in British Columbia.
It's not just based on the question of scientific uncertainty or relation to the change in the model. It's also in relation to our view about the actual situation of fishing in Area 2B. Which, as everyone knows, is even with the stable tax of the last few years, has seen the WPUE go up.
WPUE stands for weight per unit effort, and Southeast Alaska, or Area 2C, has seen those improvements as well. Southeast Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, which is Area 2A, are the only areas that will see an increase under the Commission limits for 2012. The Northwest quota will go up about 9%, while Southeast will see an increase of about 13%. Southeast commercial fishermen have weathered the biggest cuts to their individual catches in recent years. For the charter sector, the Commission also approved a proposal that will somewhat ease the maximum size restriction that was imposed on the Southeast charter fleet last year. That change will allow clients to keep one fish up to 45 inches or a so-called trophy fish over 68 inches. They had been restricted to 37 inches maximum. As far as the rest of Alaska, the biggest segment of the commercial quota is caught in Area 3A, the Central Gulf, and that will see another 17% cut this year under the IPHC limits. That comes on top of several previous years of reductions. The catch limits and other commission decisions still need approval by the federal administrations in the U.S. and Canada before they're final. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
10 large Mastiff dogs have been rescued from a residence in Kinnick in the Matanuska Valley. Matanuska Susitna Borough Animal Control officers took the dogs, an abandoned hermit crab, and two tropical fish from a residence now under investigation for a marijuana grow operation. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Borough officials and state troopers entered the residence, which is involved in an investigation unrelated to the animal charges. In all, 15 dogs were removed, along with the fish and the crab. All animals are being treated for routine health issues, according to Borough Animal Care Manager Phil Morgan.
The search warrant was issued Monday morning. We had to coordinate with state troopers, and then we went out late on Monday afternoon and found 15 dogs, the one fish and the hermit crab that were left abandoned.
Beside the Mastiffs, three Labradors, a pit bull, and a Carillion bear dog were rescued. Only one saltwater fish survived, and it and the crab have found shelter in Anchorage. Morgan says 10 of the dogs are purebred Mastiffs, some as large as 185 pounds. He says the animals were not abused. In fact, most were inside the home at the time officials entered.
There was no water available for the dogs to drink. Everything was either frozen or gone. They had eaten all the snow that was at easy access, so there was no water-type nutrition for them, and then there was no food available for them at the time either.
The owner of the home and the dogs is known to be a breeder, but now his whereabouts are unknown. Troopers and borough officials are not releasing the name of the owner until charges are made. Morgan says the new load of animals is a big one on the Matsu Animal Shelter. Large breed dogs have large appetites.
You know, it's 15 kennels that we have to make room for. Unfortunately, these are dogs that can't be housed together. You know, if it was different if we did a seizure of 15 chihuahuas, because 15 chihuahuas could fit in three or four cages, or 15 large breed dogs have to fit in 15 cages. So, you know, space is always an issue in a sheltering environment.
He says it will be about 6 weeks before the animals are ready for adoption. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
January is National Birth Defect Prevention Month. For Alaskans, the good news is that the rate of birth defects is going down. The bad news is that in 2008, Alaska's rate of birth defects was twice the rate for all Americans, and the rate for birth defects among Alaska Native infants is even higher. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Pediatrician Dr. Matt Hirschfeld is director of maternal and child health at the Alaska Native Medical Center. He says birth defects are among the most common causes of serious infant health problems and death.
Depending on what type of birth defect you have, you may need major surgery or multiple surgeries. There are occasional kids who have such a significant birth defect that they're not able to survive the defect and they pass away at a very early age. Or sometimes they're pretty disfiguring and it takes a lot of surgeries to be able to correct that, and it can cause some permanent changes in the way their faces look or the way the bodies look.
Hirschfeld encourages mothers to see a healthcare provider early in the pregnancy.
I think the most important thing they can do is to really go to their prenatal visits. One of the things that that can cause birth defects is medications. So if a mom is on a medication before she gets pregnant, that medication may no longer be safe when she actually is pregnant.
Alaska Birth Defects Registry Manager Alessa Cameron says rates for Alaska Natives are significantly higher than for others.
Even when you remove fetal alcohol spectrum disorder from analysis, the probability of an Alaskan Native infant having a major congenital anomaly is still over twice that of any other race group.
She says birth defect rates are higher among women who drink alcohol or smoke during their pregnancies, and there are also regional differences in Alaska.
The prevalence of major congenital anomalies was highest in the north and southwest regions of Alaska. So we're seeing about 4 to 5% of live births affected by a major congenital anomaly elsewhere when compared to those two regions where it's 11% in the north and 9% in southwest.
Cameron says research is underway looking at genetic, environmental, and behavioral factors that may explain the disparities. Nationally, the cause of about 70% of all birth defects is unknown. However, a lack of folic acid is a known cause. Neural tube defects are on the rise in Alaska, a trend Cameron says appears to be tied to a decline in programs pushing folic acid use. Drinking alcohol during pregnancy can lead to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. A higher percentage of infants with FASD are born to Alaska Native women than to non-natives. However, Cameron says an analysis of rates between 1996 and 2002 shows prevention programs are having an effect among Alaska Natives.
We're seeing a 49% decline among Alaska Native infants and a 64% increase for non-natives during the study period.
Doctors have not identified any level of drinking during pregnancy that is safe. Also, smoking during pregnancy can cause low birth weight, which is also tied to birth defects and other problems. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and BP.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Matt Miller. Today on AK, going to extremes. It's hard to imagine a person crazy enough to want to climb Denali alone in the depth of winter, but Minnesota adventurer Lonnie Dupree has tried and failed twice in the last 2 years. Earlier this month, heavy winds forced him to abandon his latest attempt and retreat back to base camp. AK's Annie Fike caught up with him before he left the state and has this story.
On Lonnie Dupree's last few days in Alaska, the weather was clear, and from a distance, Denali looked majestic and inviting. Dupree couldn't help wondering if he should have still been up there, making a push for the summit.
After you get down off a mountain like that, you keep looking back up at it going, oh, it looks like a good day to get up there. It looks like a day. But I've been looking at the winds aloft. And like yesterday was up there was minus 38 degrees with a 42 knot wind. So like the wind chill index would be like minus 100 or something, you know, some crazy number like that.
So instead, Dupree is at the Howard Johnson in downtown Anchorage, rummaging through three huge duffel bags looking for a few key pieces of gear.
Boots.
Dupree is loaning the Anchorage Museum some of the things he couldn't live without on the mountain for their upcoming exhibit on Denali. They'll display an expedition anorak, Wolverine mittens, and his prized birch wood skis.
I had them custom made wood skis.
Why wood?
Because I wanted to bring a little bit of Minnesota with me.
Like Dupree, the skis have survived some harsh conditions on the mountain. During his recent trip, the winds were especially strong and relentless. Dupree was forced to spend nearly a week in a tiny snow cave at 14,000 feet, where he filed this audio postcard.
The weather's been very fickle, and we have 50-mile-an-hour winds up here right now. So it's been supreme effort of patience to, of course, stay in this little cave for this long.
After 16 days on the mountain, with the extended weather forecast looking grim, Dupree decided to descend. But getting back down to base camp turned out to be a harrowing experience. He was blown off his feet in an area called Squirrel Hill. Then, just 3 miles from base camp, he got caught in a blizzard. At first, it didn't seem like much, but then the wind and snow picked up.
It was blowing so much snow sideways that it was suffocating to breathe. And the snow was sticking to my beard. And so, I mean, I had a sheet of ice over my face. It was hard to breathe, so I had to pick a hole in that ice so I could breathe through it. And then I said, well, no big deal. I'll just dig down.
But when he started shoveling, he hit glacial ice in just 3 feet, not enough room for a solid snow cave. He stumbled to another area and found the same thing. So he made do with a cave that was so low he couldn't even take a drink from his water bottle sitting up. Exhausted from digging, he went to sleep hoping for the best.
I didn't know for sure if I was going to make it or not for a short period of time there.
But when he woke up in the middle of the night, the wind was gone and he could see the full moon shining through the thin roof of his snow cave. He resumed his descent to base camp. In less than 12 hours, Dupree went from fearing for his life to remembering why he loves these types of adventures.
It was a completely magical moment. It was like everything was in a crisp black and white photograph. It was beautiful. And it's those kind of things that are the rewards that you get for the hardships you endure up there.
Dupree has spent the last 25 years finding those rewards in remote Arctic environments, including a 4-year circumnavigation of Greenland. He documents the experiences in a new book called Life on Ice. Dupree doesn't seem like the type who could sit still long enough to write a book, but in the spring of 2002, fate intervened when he broke both of his legs falling off a roof he was working on.
As a carpenter, breaking your legs in May, the start of construction season, was a bummer. But I tried to make the most of it and looked at it optimistically and said, okay, I'm going to take this summer and write.
He pulled together his journals and photographs and started whittling down the material. Nearly 10 years later, the book is finally out. Dupree saw a copy for the first time in Talkeetna after coming down off the mountain. As for the next adventure chapter in his life, Dupree isn't sure yet. But after 2 winter attempts on Denali, he does know one thing.
It's doable. It's doable, but it's only doable when the wind dies down a little bit so you can actually get up there.
So does that mean you're going to try again?
Oh.
Dupree hems and haws. A week ago, fresh off the mountain, he was sure he would never go back, but he says he's already starting to forget all the hardships. For AK, I'm Annie Feit.
And now for 300 Villages. We're off to Old Harbor. The picturesque Kodiak Island Village is located on a narrow strip of beach at the foot of a steep mountain.
It
My name is Phyllis Clough, and I work at the Old Harbor School. I'm the secretary cook. I've been working here for about 30-some years. It's beautiful. You know, everybody is pretty close. We have about 260 people was the last count that they did. It's a village. You have to rely on airplanes to get out. It's not like living in urban Alaska, you know, so you have to really love it. We have community pop-ups with the tribal council. We have gatherings at the school. There's basketball at the school. There's archery. There's all kinds of things going on in the school, you know, student council cheerleading. The majority of the people rely on subsistence, fish, crab, deer, seal. Yeah, the majority of the people are Russian Orthodox. Our church withstood the tidal wave in 1964. I was only 2 years old, so I don't remember what happened. You know, for a while there, it was actually shrinking, but in the last couple of years, we've had like three families come back, which is really nice. We even had a coffee shop open up here. So it's actually exciting to see that. We're trying to get more jobs. You know, we've had a new dock, a new boat harbor, new jobs. The water treatment center is brand new. I mean, we have a lot of people here that care about the community and want to see it be successful for the future.
That was Phyllis Clough from Old Harbor. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Fite and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week when we examine a unique profession in Alaska that has been in the spotlight recently, ice forecaster. I'm Matt Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dacia Eaton, Ellen Lockyer, Len Anderson, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Our guest host for AK this week was Matt Miller. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an Individual Artist Award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN.